Welcome everybody to episode 5 of Time for Tea 1903. This month's episode I have called Handle with Care, Crockery and Stained Glass. Isabella, tell us about the tea that we're having today for our podcast.
We are drinking Moonlight White because, well, I keep on saying let's have peach censure, but that's because I haven't tried it yet, so it's kind of selfish. But Jody suggested that we drink something delicate because we're talking about breakables.
That's right.
Breakables. Moonlight White. Fresh, sweet, and fruity. A white tea from the Yunnan province in China. Moonlight White is named because the tea leaves are withered before processing at night under the light of the moon.
Do you think this is the kind of tea that werewolves would enjoy or be terrified of?
100%. No, they'd enjoy it.
Yeah, full moon. This is the tea for a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
Werewolf tea, I'm going to call it now. I'm going to go through every menu and change the name. I'm not really.
But you should.
Let's crack on. So this episode, we're talking about delicate things in the tea room, specifically stained glass and crockery. So I thought as a warm-up, I'm interested to find out about whether your family, anyone in your family, ever had that thing called best china.
Yeah, well, kind of. We had like a specific china, and then there was like all the nice stuff that my great-grandma gave to my grandma, but my grandma was like, what is this? But my mum loved it, sort of thing. So mum had, when I say like two giant cabinets full of china, like you couldn't open the doors without it falling out. Like Beauty and the Beast style, smashing everywhere.
Was it a china cabinet?
Yeah, she had two of them.
I think this best china is one of those things that gets passed down from generations, but someone needs to put a stop to it because you don't use best china anymore.
Yeah, because like, so the one that my mum used to use when we were younger is actually, I think it's quite outdated now. It's called Port Mirian. Sorry, that is my personal opinion. It's probably quite rude to people who have it, but does your mum have some?
Nah, my family's not a best china sort of family. Which is good, I think.
Do you have like a favourite mug though and stuff like that? Because this is the thing.
No, I would say I'm the most, I'm the poshest with the mugs. My family are all, they're not very practical, but they're like, oh, I got this in Asda for 10 pence, Jodie, that kind of cup. And I'm like, that's great, but I mean, you could have spent £2 and had a really nice mug rather than 10 pence.
Yeah, it's a Maltesers one, but I mean, I like those ones.
I've definitely got a plate in my flat that I think is supposed to be hung on the wall, but I just eat off.
Cool. You don't.
But no one knows. I mean, I've just said it on the podcast.
Only
but
you
no
know.
One else
well,
knows.
I know now. Yeah, everyone knows now.
So yeah. Anyway, so we are going to talk about crockery in the episode later on because we're going to look at Burley crockery, the iconic crockery that we have in the building. But before we do that, Isabella, we had a special visitor last week to the
Brian.
Building. That's right. So Brian Hutchison came in and he is the gentleman who did the stained glass for us for the restoration. He's a professional stained glazier is probably the right word, isn't
glass
it?
Glassman.
Glassman, he's a glassman. And I didn't know this, but he also did the restoration in the 1980s, and he said he did his apprenticeship here.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about stained glass, because that's what I've been researching for this podcast. And Isabella, chip in as well as we go along, because you were there with Brian. It was fascinating, wasn't it, actually?
Yeah, I got really overexcited about stained glass windows and churches.
Isabel and I tried to get hired as his apprentices, but he would not take us.
He didn't actually acknowledge the fact that we asked, and I think it's his polite way of not saying no.
Yeah. So I've been looking at stained glass, which I knew nothing about before, apart from that churches had stained glass, and it's very pretty in churches, and it was, you know, partly to tell stories.
Stained glass seems to have been used from the Roman times, used in windows at the dawn of Christianity.
That's true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is true.
Yeah.
The idea was that it would bring you closer, like it would give you that more spiritual feeling to bring you closer to God. So feel like you're closer, walking on the same planes as them by creating this atmosphere that felt very special.
And I think that's, even though, you know, we're like really far removed with decorative glass, I still think it retains that sort of mysticism about it. Coloured glass, there's something that taps, for me anyway, taps into our psyche, like, the way that light moves through coloured glass feels a bit magical.
Well, it changes the colour of your skin when you walk through it. Yeah. Depending on where the sun is, it obviously points at different combinations of colours when they come together. And it projects patterns onto the walls and things, so it's kind of trippy.
Yeah.
So it does give you that kind of, I don't know, like ethereal feeling. Yeah. That would maybe transport you to a different place, especially at a time like back in the Roman times, which is obviously a very large period of time, but you get what I'm saying, where you wouldn't have had TVs and phones and all the kind of technology that we have today to create these things.
But you could look at a bit of glass.
Yeah, and you could be like, whoa, that's some glass.
Do you think it would be like, you know, when you watch TV now and you go, oh, just another episode, do you think they're like, I'll just look at another bit of glass?
I'll just get another tesseract.
Just do another bit of glass before I go to bed. No, not like that. So it's worth painting a picture, first of all, by saying, there's loads of stained glass here, isn't there?
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the stained glass in the building. Where are we, for example, at this very moment?
Right now. Right now, we are sitting in the Salon Deluxe. We are surrounded by the original glasswork, the original mirrored panels on the walls.
We are looking at these stained glass panels, which are botanically inspired, I suppose, floral
organic
shapes.
Yeah.
The purple is enameled glass, so right. It still counts as stained glass.
Oh, okay, cool. I wasn't sure because it has it's almost got like a matte effect that is obvious with stained glass. But you've got the stained glass, the coloured glass. Baubles hanging on the chandeliers, which would have been made by Ingrid Phillips, I believe.
Mm.
And the glass in the door, which is actually a replica.
That's right, but we have the original Salon Deluxe door, which is the largest piece of leaded Macintosh glasswork in the world, so we keep it safe in there. So I think one of the lovely things about this building is all the craft inside it, but also that the crafters are still alive. They're still alive. Like, Brian's a spry man. You know, he was on his bicycle a couple of weeks before. So it's lovely because he can come in and tell us about not only the original glass, of which, of course, he's an expert, but also the glass that he's repaired and made for us, and also just the craft in general, especially because it's like an old-fashioned mm-hmm. craft. I love hearing how these old-fashioned crafts work, really. So Brian Hutchison came in, and I'm going to be drawing a narrative thread from Brian, who repaired our glass for us, all the way back to Charles Rennie Mackintosh doing the building in 1903. Because the gentleman who did the original stained glass in this building was called Stephen Adam. He was an established stained glass man, glazier, and he ran a very successful firm. And Stephen Adam, there's a sort of inheritance line from Stephen Adam all the way to Brighton. So we can draw a line between the original stained glass person and our stained glass person now. So just to give you a bit of context, here's some of my research. So Michael Donnelly wrote this great book about Scottish stained glass, and he said that Glasgow was the second city of the empire, but the first city of glass. Because there was so much glass, stained glass, being made in the city. And that's partly because the Industrial Revolution made the population grow and everybody wanted stained glass. Buildings, churches, there was a big need for stained glass, really. So here's a description of Stephen Adam's business for you. The firm's business ranged widely, and many windows were designed for public buildings, as well as for villas and terrace houses of prosperous Glasgow merchants in the city's West End and the South Side, and commercial premises such as Pettigrew and Stevens department store, which Mackintosh did the cupola for, which is just on the corner from where we are. And in Adam's own description, high-class restaurants. So he's very busy, and there's loads of stained glass all over the city, a lot of which has been lost, which is sad. But can you imagine it, Isabella? Can you imagine all the stained glass everywhere?
I think it would be lush. Well, Art Nouveau was really big for stained glass. Prime example would be Tiffany.
Yeah.
Spectacular. They were known for a really elaborate, ornate stained glass work that kind of melded the functional and the decorative.
So Stephen Adam was born in 1848 and he died in 1910, so he was a wee bit older than Mackintosh. But I discovered that he went to school with Robert Louis Stevenson.
That's cool.
The writer, which is great. And then, get this, he did his apprenticeship. So, like with a lot of crafts, there's just a few people, like a little inner circle, and they all like apprentice each other or mentor each other, and
it's like
the mafia of stained glass, really.
Oh yeah.
So Stephen Adam did his apprenticeship with eminent glass painter James Ballantyne, and then he was assistant to Daniel Cottier. So they're the three big names in stained glass in Scotland, and Daniel Cottier was in London hanging out with our friend Dante Gabriel Rossetti,
who pops up in
every episode.
I've been saying Gabriel.
Dante
but
Gabriel
that's because
Rossetti.
Is it Gabriel? Okay, literally, I've said this before, and I have some quite straight
really
problems
know
with
either.
That's cool.
Getting himself involved in all sorts of circles of people.
A little bit tooting about.
So we're in the Salon Deluxe, looking at a Dante Gabriel Rossetti poem on the wall, Margaret MacDonald's gesso panel, And here is Dante Gabriel Rossetti, also somehow in the mix for the stained glass in the room, really. So kind of interesting that. So here's a description of, I want you to imagine what a stained glass business in Glasgow is like. Here's a description. The company's premises were extensive, comprising 6 spacious floors, admirably equipped in all parts and devoted to 1, workshops for lead working, 2, the drawing and designing of shapes and painting of patterns for approval, 3, glass painting and staining workshops, 4, the kilns for firing the glass, 5, for stock material, and 6, for packing department. So it was a big business.
A large operation.
It was a thriving operation. Less so now, but it really was.
Yeah.
And kind of related to that, I wanted to just talk a wee bit about the Glasgow School of Art and how that comes into the mix. So the Glasgow School of Art in the 1890s, this is also from Michael Donnelly. It's a great book about stained glass, actually. The manufacturing industries of Glasgow were calling out for new designers, and in line with this area of potential employment, that Fra Newbery, who was the head of the School of Art, began to develop the teaching capacities of the school. So he was a really forward-thinking principal of the School of Art, and he kind of was instrumental in getting Mackintosh the commission for School of Art.
He just
anyway.
Sounded really supportive of everyone.
He seemed like a cool guy, didn't he?
Cool dude.
Yeah. So this is Fra Newbery talking about these new crafts that he wanted to be able to teach in the school. Because before that, it was very traditional, well, quite traditional, painting. Focus on painting, right? Mm-hmm. This room has been, I won't do an accent, but imagine. This room has been specially fitted up, and artist craftsmen have been engaged to give instruction in such subjects as glass staining, pottery, repousse. I don't even know what that is. What's a repousse?
A papoose is something that you hold a child in. It's like a sling.
I don't think that's one of the workshops.
For a small baby.
I can't imagine that's one of the workshops. This room has been specially fitted up, and artist craftsmen have been engaged to give instruction in such subjects as glass painting, pottery, repousse and metalwork, wood carving, book binding, and artistic needlework. And such students who went through all these classes are our good friends, Charles Rennie Mackintosh, so he would have done some of these classes. Herbert McNair, the MacDonald sisters, shout out to Margaret MacDonald. Jessie M. King, who is an amazing...
She's cool.
She's a really interesting artist We should talk about later on. And Agnes Rayburn, another great artist.
They had quite an eclectic education, didn't they?
Yeah.
In terms of different mixed medias. Repousse, by the way, means hammered into relief from the reverse side.
Oh, maybe it's like that copper work, you know, like that you tap, 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 and then you turn over the copper and it's poking out.
I have
the
absolutely
copper.
No idea, Jodie, but yes.
Anyway, they learned all these cool crafts. So let's join that thread from the past to where we are now. So Stephen Adam did all the glass for Mackintosh. And what you'd think would happen is that when he grew old, he would pass on the business to his son, who was also called Stephen Adam Jr., also a stained glass person. But, as often happens with stories, get ready for a twist. Stephen Adam did not want to leave the business to his son, Stephen Jr., for unknown reasons, but we suspect caddishness, perhaps. Who knows? But Stephen Adam Jr.
Do you suspect caddishness?
This week I'm suspecting everyone of caddishness.
Okay.
So he didn't leave the business to his son. In fact, he left the business to another guy called Alf Webster. So this caused a massive family rift.
What's your position on this, Jodie? Like, do you need to hear both sides? Do you understand? Do you respect his decision? Or do you think maybe you could have given it to your son, man?
No, I do respect his decision.
Yeah.
I don't know his reasons, but judging by what Stephen Adam Jr. did afterwards, namely kicking up a big stink about whose name was first in the phone book and opening up a rival business called Stephen Adam Jr. Stained Glass.
Seems a bit petty.
Basically on the same street. Yeah. As his dad, Stephen Adam Stained Glass.
Gotta wonder.
I wonder if Stephen Adam Senior knew that his son was a bit of a loose cannon. You don't want a loose cannon around stained glass, do you? So Stephen Adam, the man who did the glass for Mackintosh, left the business to Alf Webster. Alf Webster was apparently a genius at stained glass, but unfortunately he was killed in the First World War. So then the business went to Alf's son, who was called Graham Webster. And Graham Webster worked with our Brian Hutchison, his dad, Neil Hutchison. So what happened was Brian Hutchison can kind of draw a line back all the way back to this building. And one of my favourite things about this whole kind of thread is that Brian Hutchison has some of Stephen Adams' original tools. So some of the brushes that Stephen Adams Sr. would have used in 1903 on this glass were again being used in 2018 on this glass.
Badger brushes.
Badger brushes, that's right. Made from a badger, probably without consent from the badger. So Isabella, what's your favourite bit of stained glass in the building?
The blue glass in the billiard room. He had found and salvaged pieces of the glass from another building instead.
That's right. I didn't know that, and I just thought it was so lovely to find out that some of the glass for the restoration is still glass from 1903. So it's the same age, but it came from a property in the west end of Glasgow. So the glass has moved across the city, right?
Yeah.
It's done a little journey. Do you remember Brian explaining how that blue glass was made?
Yes, as part of a cylinder that was, so you blow out the cylinder and then you hammer it flat.
Yeah, so he says you blow it into a blob. That was the technical word that you were reaching for.
Oh, there. I forgot that you were doing minutes for this.
That's right, yeah. Well, I wrote it down because it was technical. I wanted to get it right.
Yeah.
Blow into a blob.
Okay.
Roll into a cylinder.
Right, okay.
Put in a kiln where it heats until it's slumped and resembles toffee.
Slumped.
They're all proper stained glass words.
So does it slump as a cylinder or does it slump in on itself?
So you roll it like
a coin,
like a cylinder, and then you put the cylinder in the kiln, and then I think it unrolls.
Oh yeah, because you said it, when it heats back up, it starts to flatten itself, and then you can cut the shapes.
Cut it, right?
That's so cool.
Yeah. So I think now that we've reached our blue section of the stained glass, that's quite a nice way to segue into the other delicate thing that we're going to talk about today, which is the china, burly china, which is blue and white, but mainly blue. So Isabella, do you want to tell us a little bit about burly?
Yeah, 100%. In the billiard room, you've got the green and the purple, and then the other kind of quite prominent colour is the blue, because you've got it in the fireplace, you've got it in the tiny little squares that are in the door as you go in, you've got it in the windows that I was just talking about. And the only other part of the building really that has blue in it like that is the burlyware. A lot of people join us and ask why burlyware. Miss Cranston, she basically was just like, you know, free reign of the building, free reign artistically and imaginatively. But the one thing that I do want is the Willer pattern. So again, one of those things could be because it was part of her staple. Another idea is really that it was quite grounding for people. It was something that people would see in their day-to-day lives. And when you come into a building like this, especially in 1903, and you've got that kind of otherworldly, like, wow factor, where it's something that they've never seen before. I mean, it had light bulbs and only 2%, like, it had electricity and only 2% of the population in the city would have had electricity. So that in itself was a huge spectacle. It would have been quite a grounding presence, as if to be like, you are welcome here, and it sits you nicely at your table.
Do you know how it's made?
I do know how it's made.
Tell us how it's made.
Okay, so basically, the Willer pattern is designed by Burley of Middleport. This one that we serve from is unique to Macintosh at the Willow, and it's based on original pieces that are still held in collections and from photo analysis, so we're the only people that can get this. It is the only remaining pottery that uses the original tissue transfer method of printing, and all pieces are handcrafted using traditional techniques. So we know that, I think it's, they go through 23 pairs of hands in the process of sort of dabbing, printing to make them.
And I love the terms as well. So I was reading about how the Burley crockery in that pottery in Staffordshire is cooked three times. It goes into the kiln three times. So the first time it goes in, it's just the clay stuff. And that's when you get the biscuit version, the biscuit.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then some very talented person cuts out the transfer from the tissue that you were telling us about and sticks it on the cup and then gently kind of uses soap to get rid of the tissue so the print stays on. And then it goes in the kiln for a second time. And then you've got to put the glaze on so it goes in a third time. So I imagine it's very hot in the Burley pottery because the oven's on all the time, like all the time. One of the nice things again about the Burley is it's a craft, right? It's like the stained glass. It's been made by crafters. Burleyware is a very traditional British craft. So it's nice that the craft has been kept alive.
Well, everyone knows about blue china. If you go into any charity shop and stuff like that, you get your spode. Well, not spode usually, but you get sort of that classic blue and white china. Because in the sort of at the end of the 18th century, there was a huge influx of chinoiserie patterned objects as an interpretation of East Asian artwork. And this was basically
let's talk about
British interpretation.
Yeah, let's talk about how.
Do you want to talk about the story, Jodie?
So Burley Patton is based on a story, based on a love story, tragic love story, but it's not authentic. So no. You know, it's called China because originally porcelain came from China, and it's full of Chinese images, but images that an Englishman thought China was made.
Yeah, precisely.
So it's. I suspect Macintosh, for many reasons, absolutely hated, with the passion of a thousand suns, mm-hmm. the Burley way.
See, when you look around the room, it does work, but it wouldn't be your first... I believe that it wouldn't have been his first choice.
I believe it would be his last choice.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the black-handled cutlery and stuff like that, it just kind of goes against that.
Because it's because he was modern, right? He was modern in 1903, cutting edge, and this is very, very traditional, old-fashioned Victorian. So the story is essentially about two people who'd love to be together, but due to class, they can't be. So there was a Mandarin who had a daughter, and she wanted to. I mean, the moral of the story, you'll get the moral very quickly, right? The Mandarin was very rich, and he was so rich that he hired an accountant to count all his money.
I like it.
And then his daughter fell in love with the accountant.
Yeah.
So what do you think the moral is?
The moral is fall in love with whoever you want, and that guy's obviously dead clever, so that's cool. Oh, and sexy.
I thought the moral was don't hire accountants. Just keep your money under your bed.
We have very different ideas on how to interpret these stories though, Jodie.
And that's the beauty of a story. Although we do have an accountant here, and it's very important that we have an accountant.
Andrew's my favourite accountant.
He's a good accountant. So she fell in love with the accountant. Obviously, Mandarin Dad was like, he's not of the higher enough rank for you. I've arranged a husband for you. He's coming over. He's got a big chest of jewels, which he's going to give to me, coincidentally.
Yeah.
Not as payment for you,
because
daughter.
My accountant was like, you've spent all your money, man.
It's not like I love money and I've sold you, my daughter, to this rich person. I mean, that's exactly what happened in the story.
You're an object because you're a woman.
Exactly.
I hated.
But luckily, you know, she concocted an escape plan with her maid and got to be with the man she loved. They escaped together. And then years later, they were found and murdered by the dad. That's the penalty for true love, is found and murdered.
I can see what happened here, because they were a bit cheeky. They took his boat, they took his jewels, and they were like, see you later, Mr. Duke man.
Yeah.
And ran away with all of it.
I mean, if you're trying to paint him as the true victim of this story...
I don't feel like he is. I'm just saying at that point, I would have been like, that's a bit unfair. He finds them and has them put to death.
Yeah, so that's all on this plate. But there's also, there's some birds on the plate. Tell us about the
there's
birds.
There's the death, the joy, and then some death, money... potential money laundering. So the Duke learned of their location and he sent his guards. His guards put them to death and the couple were discovered and killed. But the gods took pity on them and transformed their souls into doves so that they may be together. So you've got these two little birds in the willow imagery, which represents their souls. Jodie, there's so much it's very stressful if you're just trying to have a cup of moonlight wine.
Why didn't the gods intervene at the beginning of the story rather than wait to the end?
Because the gods just, they love a bit of drama, don't they?
They do. They do. They're terrible.
They just wait.
That's why people ditch them.
They stoke the
drama. Why people ditch them. They were like, these guys are extra.
Yeah, they're like, it's too much.
Exactly.
The tale's origin comes from the legend of these deities called, I think it's pronounced Orihime and Hikoboshi, who are represented by the stars Vega and Altair. So according to legend, the Milky Way separates... the stars, which are basically seen as lovers. And they can meet only once a year on the seventh day of the seventh lunar month of the lunar-solar calendar.
It's famous crockery, isn't it? It's part and parcel of the building, I think.
It is really very beautiful as well, and we're actually putting the broken willow china to use. One of a local artisan, Crafted Glass is the company name, have been making pendants and earrings, brooches, cufflinks, coasters out of the Broken Beast of Burley, which is a really great way to repurpose it.
So you can buy the Burley in the shop, and it's very popular. The little jugs are really popular for like little presents for people, because it is nice for afternoon tea. And then the jewellery as well, the upcycled jewellery, you can buy there.
And you can wear the tragic love story on your chest.
That's right, yeah. But the lovely thing about the broken jewellery is you can just pick the doves. Right, so let's do it. Let's go back in time. Back in time. What I asked Isabel to have a wee look at for our special end topic was, and this is the title I've given it, There's Tea in My Moustache, Strange Problem-Solving Crockery of the Past. So I was interested in weird crockery, because we're talking about crockery. Okay. And I'll kick us off, because one of the things that we have for our education programme...
I love that so much. It's beautiful.
..is a handling box, which teachers can borrow, full of things to that inspire you for lessons. But one of the lessons is about mystery objects. And in the handling box, I've included a cup, which... spoiler alert, is called a moustache cup. So, Isabella, could you maybe describe what a moustache cup is?
I love this cup. So, the cup itself has a little sort of almost like bamboo-y like formed handle as well. It has, on the rim of the cup where you would put your lip, there is almost like a little bridge. So if you imagine your lip on the edge of the cup, this little bridge would go between your nose and your top lip in order to protect your moustache.
Yeah.
What if your moustache is bigger than this, Jodie?
Well, you shouldn't be drinking tea. You really? Can only drink ale.
You drink it with a straw. Only drink ale, and you just get that little white foam on there.
That's right, yeah. So this is a moustache cup, and one of the things I love about the moustache cup is if you're not in the know, if you don't know that it's a moustache cup, it's great. So I showed it to... it's great for guessing, because I showed it to Sarah, our head pastry chef, and she had no idea. She didn't have a clue what it was for. There we go. So, Isabella, that's a moustache cup for you.
I love it.
Lots of fun. Tell me about some kind of strange crockery that you've been investigating.
I was looking at tea leaf reading cups. So,
like fortune-telling cups?
Fortune-telling cups. So when you, obviously... when you usually read tea, I mean, I say obviously, like I do it all the time. I don't.
Usually, when I usually read tea.
You know
leaves.
When you read tea? Yeah, so you basically, you don't use a strainer, tea leaves go to the bottom, you drink it, and you leave about a teaspoonful of water in with the tea leaves, and then the drinker swirls it around a couple of times, and then I believe that some people turn it upside down, and then there's some sort of, I don't know.
Residue?
Yeah, no, I just mean like there's some sort of dance with the tea handle, just turn it this way, turn it that way, make it or you just swirl it about a bit and then you see where the leaves fall, my friend.
Right, so but we're going to try it now, aren't we? So I'm going to be the recipient of Isabella's tea leaving prowess.
I've got a step-by-step instruction here.
Right, so I'm ready. Step one, arrive at the fortune teller's house.
Let the tea steep for a few minutes.
Oh, I started earlier than you. So So who should pour the tea?
Don't think it matters. Okay. Let's get some tea in your cup, Joey. Gonna read your leaves.
No strainer. I mean, Miss Grant's will be turning in a grave. No strainer.
Raging.
See, now if you just... No, I feel like what Isabella's done now is cheating slightly.
No.
She's just scooping some leaves right in there.
Well, do you know what? It's...
She's fast-forwarding.
You make your own future.
You're encouraging the process, aren't you? Yeah. You're helping the fortune along a little bit. Because we live in modern times where everything's a bit faster. Attention spans are shorter. So I presume I have to do something for it to be mine.
So you have to drink it.
So I have to drink it, right? I'm just going to swig it. I'll swig it. All I need to do is like make my body, like, has contact with the medium of fate, right?
Cool, yeah.
I've never said that sentence before.
It's because it's really weird.
I've never seen it again. Here we go. All right, I'm drinking tea, guys. I'm drinking the tea, but just for fortune reasons.
Do it. Okay, it's quite hot. Well, if you just leave like a teaspoon.
Oh, I actually ate some.
Do you get
tea.
A chunk?
Yeah,
that's some good roughage.
Not to like. This is how you see, seeing the sausage made here, guys. I'm just pulling some of these tea leaves out.
I think I'll just breathe really loudly into the microphone too.
Here we go.
Swirl the cup in your left hand counterclockwise, and then you invert the cup so you can turn it up over onto your tea. Your tea saucer.
Onto my saucer.
Your saucer. And then turn the cup over from the right-hand side. Look closely at the pattern of leaves.
I'm almost certain, Isabella,
yeah,
and I don't want you to freak out too much about this,
okay,
that I can see a pigeon in yours.
It kind of does look like one. Okay. With a big beak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay.
But apparently that's that. Actually, the bottom indicates a distant future. I can see a man with a mustache.
Well, that's unsurprising, knowing my dating history.
In your distant future, Jodie.
Super.
The side indicates the medium term. So, what you got there?
Okay, so you've got, like, just one leaf on one side and then one leaf on the other, separate. There's going to be a huge gulf. Don't blame me.
I'm not...
Don't shoot the messenger.
Sorry, I didn't mean to look at you quite so viciously.
What have I got on my side?
Shockingly, then you need to prepare yourself for this.
I'm ready.
From what I can tell, it's a banana and a small spatula. Maybe you're going to go to, like, a creperie. And they're going to be flipping some pancakes.
I do like pancakes.
Chopping some bananas for the pancakes.
I'm happy with my fortune so far, right? Yeah. Okay, what about the rim? Because you've got some deluge on the rim. You've
name
got
of my band.
An axe. You're chopping something as well. There's like a thing that's being chopped by a hatchet.
I don't know what this is. It looks like a little teepee.
Okay, so I'm ready to read your whole thing. Okay. So, and you said the bottom is like the future. Starting from the top of the rim, you kill a pigeon with an axe in a fit of rage. I'm just telling the story, it's not me, right?
Yeah.
And because of this, you have to go far, far away from everybody because of this heinous crime.
Okay.
And then when you die, you're reincarnated as punishment into a giant pigeon, which the city attacks out of fear.
To be honest, with the teepee being close, you're gonna go traveling. You're just going to be chilling. You're going to have your crepes and
sweet,
your bananas.
Sweet.
That means you could be going somewhere tropical. And then you're going to meet a man with a mustache. He has pretty angry eyebrows, but I think you guys are going to get
on. I could be into that. See if you can make him
kind of looks like Macintosh. Do you see what I mean? The mustache and then the...
I do. I mean, I feel a bit weird about the fact that we're doing a Macintosh podcast and you've seen Charles Winnie Macintosh in the bottom of my teacup.
It feels a little bit too...
Leading.
Leading. But that's on the leaves, not me.
So there you go. Well, that's absolutely fascinating and highly scientific, and I look forward to that life that you've painted for me.
Well, let me know when you're going for the pancakes. I'll come with you.
Well, you can't because you're exiled because of the pigeon murder. So that is pretty much all we've got time for in our episode about Delicate. Stained glass and crockery at Macintosh at the Willow. Isabella, have you enjoyed yourself this episode?
I have very much enjoyed it. It is the start of Pride Month, so we're excited to do some more fun social media based things.
That's right, yeah. Happy Pride to all of our queer friends in the queer community and all of our staff who identify in the queer community as well, and everybody in Glasgow as well.
Exactly.
It's a super time in the city, actually, and I'm really happy that the chefs made that amazing rainbow cake.
Yeah,
it's
we've started
so
off
good.
The rainbow cake, which is really nice. Yes, follow us on Instagram at the Willow, and follow us on Facebook. And if you want to make any bookings or have any questions, contact us on bookings@macintosh@thewillow.com.
We will see you, but not see you because it's a podcast. Next month. Bye.
Bye.